Well, I think most of you wrestling fans out there know, and I think there's a lot of you, most of you know that in order to succeed in professional wrestling, right, you got to have a signature move. You got to have a final move. It's the move that when the fans see it coming, they say, oh no, this is the end, he's going to do that. Right? You got to have it. For a guy named the Baron von Raschke, he had the claw. And he would wrestle somebody, and whenever the claw came out, people said, oh no, this is it, it's going to end. And he would go up and he'd get their head and he'd put the claw on them, and it was over. For a guy named Ric Flair, he had something called the figure four leg lock. I don't know, that's self-explanatory, right? Whatever that is. That was his final move, the figure four leg lock. Now there's Jake the Snake. This guy was the guy that would come out with a python into the ring wrapped around him. Jake the Snake. He had the DDT. I had to look that up because I didn't know if he came out with Roundup or what. But his final move was when he took somebody's head and he would sort of take them and drive them into the mat. And, of course, nobody can get through that. Roddy Piper had the sleeper hold. If he got that hold on you, no matter what, you were unconscious. You were out. And then there was that gruesome fellow, the Undertaker. Remember him? Wow, he was scary. His final move, the pile driver. The pile driver. For the record now, I just read about this stuff. I don't know about it. I don't watch it. Okay, I just want to be clear about that. I just read about it. I did watch it as a child. At home, and remember the days of studio wrestling and Bill Cardill. And I did watch a little bit with my boys when they were growing up, but it's not something I'm real interested in. But I think it has a bearing on my thoughts of Genesis chapter 32 when I read about Jacob and his wrestling match with God. I mean, somehow in my mind I have these actors and these characters, and I think, really? You're telling me that Jacob, the father of Israel, patriarch of the Old Testament, and God, our creator, you're telling me there's some kind of a WWF wrestling match at the Jabbok? It seems problematic. And it is for many, for many. There are problems. There are questions in this text. I mean, one question, the big one is, who is this that Jacob wrestles with? The actual literal Hebrew says, and Jacob wrestled with a man. But he doesn't seem to be an ordinary man, right? When Jacob asks his name, he doesn't give it. Why do you ask? And he, in fact, has the power to give Jacob a new name. He gives him a new name. And he says to Jacob, if he is God, right, who can give a new name and who can bless? And yet, if he is God, he says, you have wrestled with God and men and overcome. And the big problem, the big question is, wait a minute, how can you beat God? How can you even come to a draw in a wrestling match with your Creator? That's a tough one. Let me go. It's almost daylight. It's almost like Dracula or something, right? You can't be out in the sun. It's strange. But Jacob calls the place Peniel, which means I have seen the face of God. And who else but God can really give a blessing? Who else can really change not just a man's name, but this is the birth of a nation. They're still called Israel today. Thousands of years later, we call them Israel, the nation of Israel. And And this is where, this is it. This is the first time. This is when it started. This is the origins. This is where it all began, in this wild wrestling match. And who could do that other than God? Now, many have sought to come up with other people. He's wrestling with an angel. He's wrestling with Esau, who he's going out to meet, but Esau somehow sneaks in at night and wrestles him. Some have said that he even wrestles his dad, which is... he was blind and feeble a long time before this. And I even read one commentator who believed that, well, that Jacob wrestled himself. He wrestled his own demons, which seems absurd, doesn't it? Well, we know his history, Jacob, right? He was a twin. He was the second one born, and he comes out of the womb with his hand on the heel of his brother. He's grabbing his brother, and hence the name Jacob. It means grabber. He's a grabber. He's a cheater. He's a conniver. He's a shyster. He's a wheeler and dealer. That's what he is by name. And this wheeling and dealing characterizes his life, right? I mean, from the very beginning, coming out of the womb, trying to come out first ahead of his brother. And then he deceives his brother into his brother. Esau is very hungry, and he says, well, I'll make you this certain food you like, this certain dish you like, but I want the birthright. And he wheels and deals. And then when it's time for his dad to give a blessing, because the oldest male always gets the stuff, it's time for the dad to pass that on. The dad, Isaac, is blind. And Jacob and his mom concoct this scheme where, because Jacob doesn't have hair and Esau does, he puts goat's hair on his arms, and the dad will grab him and think he's the older brother. Well, that doesn't make the brother very happy, and Jacob has to get out of town. And there he hooks up with his uncle, Laban. And with Laban, his uncle, he works for Laban. He takes care of his flock. Laban gives him his daughters. He has children. And Jacob decides it's time to leave. So he says, well, I'll tell you what. I'll make a deal with you, Uncle Laban. You just give me the goats and the flock that have spots, and you can take the ones that are unspotted. Laban says, sounds like a good deal. And Jacob comes up with this dye, okay? He does something with the weeds and the water, and the flock drink it, and they come out spotted. Unbelievable shyster. He has one more trick up his sleeve now. He's heading back home. His brother Esau is coming out to meet him. He figures he's mad and there's going to be trouble. He's got one more trick up his sleeve. He's going to divide the group into two. The women, the children, and the flocks, and everything he has. He's a wealthy man now. And he's going to divide it into two and send them two different directions. And he figures Esau might get half of what he has or half of his people, but he won't get them all. And he finds himself alone at night, wrestling by the Jabbok. There's an interesting play on the words here. Jabbok and wrestle and Jacob are all almost identical words. And so that's a neat thing that happens there in the text. And from this event, we get the name change. We get the beginning of Israel. And that name, as we read, means what? He who struggles with God. He strives. He struggles with God. And struggle is another defining character of this man's life. If wheeling and dealing is a part of his life, certainly the struggle that he has in life is evident everywhere. But here's the interesting thing about Jacob. In all of these wheeling and dealings, in all of these struggles, he comes out on top. he comes out being blessed. I mean, he did get the birthright, didn't he? He actually did get it. And his father actually did bless him. And he manages to get that, and he's blessed. And even when he runs away and he's sleeping, he has that dream of the ladder and the angels and God's, you know, after this huge struggle for the birthright, God comes to him and he gets it. He struggles to get a wife and a family. He loves his wife, Rachel, and you remember what happens. His uncle, who it seems like it runs in the family, right? He deceives Jacob. And is this whole thing where, I don't know how, but the honeymoon was spent with the sister instead of the wife, and he didn't know it, and it's another far out story. But anyway, he's deceived, but he has to work 7 years for his wife, and he's deceived into getting the wrong sister, and then he has to work another 7 for the one he really wants. And he struggles for his wife. He struggles with his family. He struggles to become prosperous. But he does become prosperous. He gets very rich. He increases his children. How many children does he have, right? 12 tribes of Israel. And his children and his flocks and all of his stuff, he's blessed. And now here he is struggling with God. And guess what? He comes out on top. He comes out of it with a blessing. All of his struggles have given rise to blessings. And this one is no different. And that's what I think is the key theme in this story and in our readings today. Though there are many. But this is the one I want to focus on. That in the struggle, there is blessing. And that is because of who God is and because of his word. But there is blessing in the struggle. And I'll take it even further and say this, that the struggle in our faith, the struggle in our spiritual life is necessary. It is absolutely a necessary component in our relationship with the Lord. And it's inevitable also. Struggling, as you know, is inevitable. It will happen. Paul tells Timothy, "For bad times are coming. I want to warn you, there's some bad times coming. There's some hardship ahead. You got to endure suffering. You got to stay connected. You got to hang on to the Lord. You got to hang on to the scriptures you were taught as a child, because you are headed for a struggle. And so there's blessing in the struggle. The struggles are necessary and they are inevitable." Now, you might be familiar with this word. I think it's one of those words now that are overused, right? The people on cable news and commentators and all these people, they love this word, and they just use stuff too much. You get tired of hearing it. It's the word chutzpah. He has chutzpah. She has chutzpah. And we hear it a lot. It's a Jewish word. It's a Yiddish word. But its roots actually go back to the Old Testament, to a Hebrew word. It means audacity, insolence, impudence. It means to have gall, to be brazen, to have nerve. It means incredible guts is what it means. Tenacity. And this persistence, this tenacity, this what the Jewish people call chutzpah, this has a long history with the Jewish people and a long history in our Old Testament. It is something that is actually, while we may look down and say, boy, she has a lot of gall. Boy, he's got a lot of nerve to do that. We may say it in a derogatory manner, but actually in the scriptures, it's applauded. It's revered. Leaders need it. Abraham had it. Remember Abraham's negotiations about Sodom and Gomorrah? If there's 50, if there's 40, if there's 10, you remember him actually out there on the plains arguing with God about this? Do you remember Moses? He had it. When God said, I'm sick of these people, I'm going to destroy them, you can go out and I'll make another nation out of you. And Moses says, oh, wait a minute now, you can't do that. And there's that text where it seems as though Moses and God get in this struggle and God changes his mind. David had it when a little teenage boy went out with a slingshot to fight a 9-foot giant with a big sword and armor and all of those things. David had chutzpah, persistence. Jacob had it. And down through Jewish history, it's something that's admired, it's respected. There is, legend tells us of a guy named Coney the circle drawer. And this guy, Coney, he would draw a circle and he would get in and he would pray. Well, there's no rain, it tells us, and Josephus talks about him. There's no rain in Israel at this time, in Jerusalem. And this Coney, he gets in the circle and he says, God, I'm praying for rain. I'm not giving up. I'm not getting out of here. I'm not going anywhere until you make it rain. That's his tenacity with God. And so it starts to sprinkle. And Coney says, no, that's not good enough. I want it to really rain. And it really rains. And it really rains to the point where the people say, Coney, could you get back out there and pray that it stops? Psalm 121 that we read today is a psalm of struggle. It's a psalm of ascent. It's a psalm of people journeying to Jerusalem for the feasts. And the difficult journey, the hot sun, the cold night, the moons, the terrain, the bank, the robbers, the thieves. And it's a story of struggle and God's protection in that struggle. And so when Jesus tells this parable in Luke 18 about prayer, he is identifying with this history of having raw nerve, of being persistent in your prayer, in your relationship with God. That's what he's connecting to. And in his book on these parables, Brad Young says this, when he speaks of these parables about prayer, he said, the problem with prayer is God. Say that again. The problem with prayer is God. It's not our words. It's not our liturgy. It's actually our understanding of the nature of God. And so Jesus tells these parables. There's one in Luke 11 about a friend knocking on the door and just keeps beating, and the person doesn't want to get out of bed, and he just says, no, I can't get out, and the person persists. That goes hand in hand with this judge parable about the widow who comes to the corruptible judge. And actually, these are meant to be humorous. They're rhetorically, it's a rhetorical method that Jesus used that was common in that day. And this parable, along with Luke chapter 11, the contemptible friend and the corrupt judge, are humorous stories that by exaggerating these characterizations and these actions that are so unlike God, you give people a picture of what is so unlike him, a friend who won't get out of bed and let you in, a judge who won't help a poor, innocent, destitute widow. And you, by using those, you get the listener to understand what God is really like. What God is really like. It's exaggerated behavior of a person who refused to help a friend or a judge unconcerned about a helpless widow. And it's reversed in the divine character. Because you see, when it comes to prayer, the disciples prayed as if their God were like an untrustworthy friend or an evil judge, unconcerned about their needs. Now, I will say this, that today, as I preach this sermon and do this, I preach it to myself mainly. I hope you like it. I hope you get something. But I know that it speaks to me because I have been in prayer about things, about a certain thing recently. And I have to admit that I've been like the disciples. That in my praying, I pray, yes, but I pray with the idea that God is not a contemptible friend. He's not a corrupt judge. I pray, Jesus said, look, if you know who I really am, if you really knew me, you would persist. You would not give up. You would have chutzpah, okay, in your prayer life if you knew how much I cared, how much I love you. If you knew my real nature. And he puts forth this parable to show that God is so opposite. The judge is at the top of the heap. He's the ruler in the land. He's a man. He's a judge. He has the court. The widow is at the bottom. She's a woman. She's a widow. She has absolutely nothing. And the judge could care less. But the judge says, she's wearing me out. And he uses the word hypopiezo. It's the word for boxing. It's the Greek word that they use when they had the matches and they had the games like the Olympics, you know, and the boxers, the fighters. It's called hypopiezo. That's the word the judge uses here. He says, she's beating me. She's beating me down. She's boxing me down with her persistence. That was her only weapon. She had nothing else in her toolbox but persistence, but chutzpah, but raw nerve, guts. And so Jesus said, if she could do that with this corruptible judge, why won't you persist knowing who I am and how I feel about you? By giving a comical characterization of what God is not like, Jesus teaches them what God is really like. He's like a good and trusted friend. He's like a righteous and conscientious judge who helps those in need. Yes, there will be struggles. It's definite. We will have struggles. But because of who God is, we need to persist like Jacob. And at the end, there's blessing. Interesting way that this text ends, right? We have that on the front. When the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on the earth? It's odd because it doesn't seem like the story's about faith. Where did that come from? I thought we were talking about a secular judge and a woman, and there doesn't seem to be any spiritual connection at all going on here. And so all of a sudden Jesus closes it by saying, when the Son of Man comes back, will he find faith? And so many who know more than me, many theologians and commentators believe that actually that this is an allusion to, and the meaning here is that Jesus is saying, when the Son of Man comes back, will he find chutzpah among us? Persistence? Tenacity? Raw nerve in our spiritual life?